that October Cornell. That was the time when Paul Corey was moving to Cornell. Leo recognized an opportunity for the sixth one, took advantage of the opportunity to do a postdoc with Paul Corey, and led to a long association, both professional and personal association between Leo Mettenberg and Paul Corey. Really, I think Leo could talk on two different kinds of topics at a symposium such as this one. I'll come to the topic he's actually going to talk on in a moment, but one might have imagined a situation where he could have spoken on the obligation and the role of those of us who know that polymers are important and fascinating to get that idea across as much as we can to as many people as we can. He has done this by a very popular book, An Introduction to Macromolecules, that is written not for the practitioner in the art of polymers, but to get people to know very little about polymers to a position where they can better appreciate what polymers are. He certainly has done it with regard to training to the students, and also from the point of view of trying to train existing faculty in chemistry departments. Maybe I should have put that a little bit differently. The point of view here is that polymers are a relatively new type of molecule, new in terms of the history of chemistry. And many of the faculty in chemistry departments who might be easily persuaded that chemists should pay more attention to polymers in their teaching just simply don't have the training with which to do that. Both Paul Corey and Leo Mettenberg recognize that as a very important activity for those of us who know that polymers are both important and fascinating types of molecules. But today, instead, he's going to talk on another topic that's also important. It's one that is almost synonymous with the name Leo Mettenberg. Anybody who's interested in crystalline polymers certainly is aware that Leo Mettenberg has worked in the field. Some of them perhaps to a little bit of discomfort if they happen to have some ideas about crystalline polymers, which are a rather controversial type of polymer, that run into trouble when they must confront the experiments that Leo has done. Anybody who wants to explain what crystalline polymers are and how they behave must confront the experimental evidence. And Leo is the ultimate person in giving us that experimental evidence. Leo Mettenberg, R.O.L.A.N. professor at Florida State University, and crystalline polymers.
I think after that introduction, I ought to just say it's time to go home. I don't think I can do any better than that. Am I audible here? Thank you for a fine introduction, Wayne. And I'd like to thank the organizing committee and the chairman of this symposium for the very distinct privilege of inviting me to participate. Paul Corey had a very important and significant influence in my life, both as a teacher and a friend over many, many years. And it is indeed a privilege and an honor to be able to talk at this symposium out of here today. In addition, he introduced me to the subject of the talk this afternoon, and he made, in his own way, some of the very basic contributions to the field. And I think that as a, for two purposes, first to serve as a background as to what I want to talk about, what I will be talking about this afternoon, and the fact that if we are historians, we might say that the revisionists are already among us, I thought it might be useful to briefly review, or just really highlight, some of his contributions to the field, not necessarily in chronological order, but in some sort of logical order, as it appears to me. So if I could have the first slide, please. Okay, we start back in 1949, and I think 1955, the Statistical Thermodynamics Co-Polymer. The first paper was actually done when Paul was on the staff here at Goodyear in Akron. And this is a paper which establishes the first time that the fusion of polymers, the melting crystallization process, is a first order transition and shows that it can be treated almost in a classical manner. And they have to apply this to the melting of electrolyte fractions, the polymer diluent mixtures, and to copolymers. They also pointed out this 1949 paper, which I strongly recommend for those interested in this field to read, that the crystalline, not crystalline boundary, or the crystal amorphous boundary, as it was known then, could not be sharp. And this was, and also introduced the concept of the importance of the interfacial free energy and its uniqueness in chain molecules. And this was back in 1949. Going down a little road and trying to move along, there was a series of papers at Cornell on crystallization kinetics and sphere-like growth rates. And here is shown that the crystallization kinetics of chain molecules, essentially classical in behavior in the sense that they follow the Brahmi kinetics. He was the first to show, and I think very important, that polymer crystallization was a nucleation control process. And I might point out, in those days, he didn't know, or we didn't know about lamellar or folded chains. But from a very general observation, you can conclude that we had a nucleation control process. With A.D. McIntyre, not our Don McIntyre, but different McIntyre, they studied the rate formation of sphere-like growth, and also showed that that was also a nucleation control process. It's an experiment that I can say has probably been repeated on every crystalline polymer that has since been made. This was on some polyaliphatic polyesters, always with the same result, very strong temperature coefficients, indicative of nucleation control. Getting a little closer to modern times, in 1963, with Jackson and late Bob Chang, he pointed out by some rather simple density measurements accomplished by centrifugation that the so-called single crystals that were appearing then were not completely crystalline, and about 20% of the material of the system was indeed some type of disordered overlayer. This work, to be conservative, was severely criticized on both theoretical and experimental grounds, and it turned out that it's a very central and fundamental set of experiments which has stood the test of time some 27 years later and amply confirmed by a variety of other experimental techniques. And it was important, and this was the first lesson right there in that paper, that solution crystals, no matter how pretty they look, are not completely crystalline. And this must be taken cognizance of when you try to understand their properties. We have next the formation of the lamellar crystallites and the structure of the interface, grouping them together. In 1962, Paul Fleury set forth the fundamental reason that one formed lamellar crystallites, namely the problem or the need to dissipate the flux of chains that emanated from a crystal face and tried to get into the disordered liquid-like or isotropic region. This required some type of folding and the formation of lamella. And he also pointed out, well, the corollary, he pointed out that you did not have to manipulate the work with monomeric nucleation theory to explain the fact that one has lamellar crystallites. It was a consequence of the conformational differences in the crystalline state and in the isotropic or liquid-like state. In a rather significant paper in 1984 with Hume and Hill, he worked out the structure of this interface, and this is really a tour de force, and it cleaned without worrying about the details, and as I go along later on in my talk, we'll talk about some of the results. The things they pointed out that were important, that one has to take into account the bending energy, or the free energy that it takes to make a bend or a fold, and also be concerned with what would call the tilt angle. And lots of papers have been coming along in the last few years. And last night, as I was coming into Cleveland thinking about some of these things, I sort of had a deja vu. That's the right way to pronounce it. My French isn't very good. There are a lot of papers, Opie and I would predict that every 2 or 3 months there'll be either the Journal of Chemical Physics or Macromolecules, a paper dealing with the structure of the interface. And the recollection is 20, 25 years ago with the problem of the intramolecular excluded volume. And after a while, I think there still is, but for a while there, every month in the Journal of Chemical Physics, there was at least one paper considering from some point of view the problem of the intramolecular excluded volume. But the structure of this paper is a particularly vital paper, and it points out using a lattice technique the nature of the interfacial structure, and we'll talk about that a little more later. On the last item on this slide, the melting temperature molecular weight relation. This was work that was done in Marie. And here they looked at the molecular weight, the melting temperature as it depended on molecular weight for uniform chain lengths. And they could account for the melting temperature and the enthalpy of fusion for normal hydrocarbons up to C100, which was all that was available in 1963, and allowed for a very good extrapolation to the infinite, to the melting temperature of the infinite chain. Now, recently, it's last year or two, there has been synthesized in Keller's laboratory and in Beckman's laboratory independently normal alkanes up to C390. Now it's going to be very interesting, and it's going to allow for a further test of the Fourier-Brief theory when we have available thermodynamically significant melting temperatures as well as enthalpies of fusion to see how good the theory is when we now have data for much higher normal hydrocarbons, or indeed whether it's going to be any type of revision. Knowing time, I hope it won't be too long, we'll be able to answer that question. And we finish up. I guess I went reverse. Here we are. Then we have the period of 1956-1957, the consideration of the elastic mechanisms of fibrous macromolecules, proteins, and polymers, and the influence of the crystallization melting process on the pores, length, temperature relation for the thermoelastic properties. From this, a formal mechanism for contractility and tension development can be developed. And its applicability of these ideas to functioning biological systems still remains to be exploited. In the same line, for inert systems, with Holt and with Spur, was able to demonstrate coexistence curves with suspended natural rubber and collagen. In the 70s and 1981, with the advent of neutron scans and small angle neutron scattering, with Do Yoon, was able to analyze the small angle neutron scattering patterns of polyethylene and polypropylene, both crystallized in bulk and from diluted solution. And from that, deduce the chain structure and what we would call the molecular morphology. And the problem of the adjacent reentry was addressed directly by their analysis, and they concluded that this could not be a very significant effect. And the last item, which is not too well recognized, was his contribution to the study of mechanical properties of crystal polymers. There's a paper with Yoon and Nature, which is concerned with the problem of molecular morphology in general. But there is a short section in this paper which points out the importance of the non-crystalline regions to large deformation, that is, the force length curves, stress strain curves. And in this short section, the important role of partial melting recrystallization is postulated, argued very strongly. This latter point was confirmed about 2 years ago in a set of elegant experiments by George Whitnell and Wendy Wu. Overstay my time, I think some of the results from our laboratory will be consistent with this postulate. So what I've tried to outline here very briefly, and not completely, and certainly not with complete justice, are some of the rather fundamental contributions to the field of crystal polymers and flexible chains that we have as a result of his work, and the fact that they have indeed stood the test of time, some for a long number of years. Some, I think, as we recognize, were controversial at the time, but as I mentioned, they have withstood the test of time, namely experiment and further theoretical analysis, and they serve really as the basic foundation for this whole subject. Now, although we have this basic foundation, we still have some problems, and we have the problems, if we're concerned in some detail, about properties, particularly macroscopic properties of crystalline polymers, will depend on molecular structure. And the reason we have the problems is because answering this question involves understanding in some detail some of the morphological features, how they are controlled, and how they indeed affect the properties. And this is what I would really, this is what I'd like to spend the rest of my time discussing in a succinct way, the relation between structure and properties. And that's like saying we love mommy and apple pie. And to be more specific, we should first recognize that there are two elements of structure that we have to be concerned with. One is the element of molecular structure, namely the chain structure, molecular constitution, things like molecular weight, structural regularity, and the other are the structural factors that determine the properties of the crystalline state. And the plan that we try and follow, or the strategy that we will be using, is to try and identify the structural factors that describe and determine the crystalline state, to see how these are affected by molecular constitution and crystallization conditions, and then see how they can be isolated, how the structural properties of these can be isolated, for example, properties, and the properties that I'd like to focus on here along will be this afternoon, mechanical properties. Now we start with the concept that we have lamellar-like crystallites, and we'll see their limitations. And then the first question to address is what are, or what appear to be, the independent structural variables which govern the properties of semi-crystalline polymers. And I think we have identified some of them. There very well may be more. And let me go on the next slide when we have prepared. I can't tell from here. Is this in focus? Okay. Well, we have the obvious level of crystallinity, which some years ago was considered to be a proper concept, which I think is now shown, and now be shown to be a rather quantitative concept. We have, what I've listed, perhaps incorrectly, but get the idea, of course, the residual amorphous structure. It's a structural feature that's been pretty well ignored. It's important. This is essentially what's left behind by the crystals, and we'll talk some about that in a moment. We have the crystallite thickness, the crystallite thickness distribution, which can be experimentally determined by a variety of methods and depending on the polymer that you're studying. We have the interface, the interface, or the interface, or the interfacial structure, what the structure is, and the relative amount, that's the extent in the particular system. We also have the question of the variable of the internal structure. Are we seeing double here? Let me focus it better. Well, let me focus it better. There we go. Let me go down here. Pardon? Let me go down there. Well, if you can focus it, okay, you want to put the slides? I don't know why the focus is changing. Tilt angle, which is the angle between the chain axes, and the basal plane of the lamellic crystallites. And we also have the super question of the supramolecular structure, which is the way in which the crystallites are organized relative to one another, or not organized. The organized form, most popular ones, of course, the formation of spherulites, that would be a form of a supramolecular structure. So these are a set of independent structural variables which, as a consequence of experience, play an important role in the determination of many properties. Now, before examining how molecular structure affects these things, we will, I think it's informative to see how a polymer crystallizes in a very formal way. So, Wade, if you're mine, can I have the next one, please? No, you're going the wrong way. Nice. So here we have a crystallization kinetics of isotherms. We have the vertical axis, 1 minus lambda, which is the extent of the transformation, against the log of time on an arbitrary axis. This is one decade. And what we've done is taken a set of fractions of linear polyethylene at a given temperature, 127 degrees, and put them all, taking their different time scales, and since they all start with the same shape, push them together so they all form one isotherm, all starting the same way. The solid line is the classical monomeric Rankine crystallization kinetics, running from zero, no transformation, to one, complete transformation. And we run approximately from 10 to the 4th to 10 to the 6th. And there are several important features here. One is that they all start the same way. So all of their respective of the molecular weight, these are fractions, crystallization kinetics, always starts the same way, following a Brahmi. It starts to deviate from the Brahmi at different levels of crystallinity, depending on the molecular weight. The lower the molecular weight, the higher up you go. The high molecular weight, you start deviating much lower. And the other point is, when after they deviate, we're on a log time scale, they are essentially flat. It takes a long time, a log time scale, to get this 10 to the 6th molecular weight to increase its crystallinity very substantially, or very significantly, rather. So molecular weight has sort of two effects. And in a practical sense, it tells us that we have a limit on the level of crystallinity that we can attain. In this case, it's running roughly, we'll see the numbers in the next slide in a moment much better, for about 80% to 30%. And it also tells us there must be something, because you can wait, you know, for long, long times here and nothing is happening. The fact that it's leveling off is not a time factor. It tells us there must be some structures in this residual non-crystalline region, some topology, some topological features, which essentially retard the crystallization process. This is an experimental fact, got nothing to do with the arguments of whether you have reptation or segmental relaxation, or what's happening mechanistically. Just nothing is happening as you get far enough along in time, and we essentially stop the crystallization process dead. Now, if we can have the next slide, you can see the results of this a little clearer, perhaps a little cleaner. This is for linear polyethylene. And we have the degree of crystallinity, or the extent of the transformation, on the density scale against the log of the molecular weight. And there's nothing very interesting happens. It stays about 80-90% until you get to 10 to the 5th, and then it starts dropping down, and it drops down to about 40%, which is what we saw before. What will happen if we get higher? I don't know. Now, this isn't something that's unique to polyethylene, although polyethylene is going to be the major vehicle that will be looking at things this afternoon. The next slide, I believe, shows it for several different polymers, for polyethylene and polyethylene oxide, perhaps coincidentally, fall on essentially the same line, with identical molecular weight fractions, getting down to about 30%, 30, 40% crystallinity of the high molecular weight. This is an aromatic polysilicon polymer that McGill has been studying, and it seems to show the same trends. And this is for trans polyisoprene, some data in the literature. This is all that we have. So that the extent of crystallinity, and these are waiting long times. These are not consequences of time effects. The kinetics of time have all been taken care of. So this is a rather large effect, and it can't be attributed to any groups or the cilia or things like that, because you see they're going in the opposite direction. We're decreasing the concentration of N groups as we increase the molecular weight. So if we look at the polyethylene, polyethylene oxide, these are after crystallization temperatures, up to about 10 to the 5th. It stays pretty high level, and then it starts to drop rather drastically. The next slide, thank you, Wayne, shows that we bring the same samples, the same kind of experiment, down to room temperature, looking at density, but it's the same result. Density of 1 is 100% crystallinity. If we crystallize it, and we see the same sort of effects, depending on how you crystallize now, we can change the level of the crystallinity, or the level of density, but not particularly the trend with molecular weight. And if we went to branch systems or copolymers, we reduce the level of crystallinity even further. So that from the point of view of wanting to examine how this structural factor, the level of crystallinity, influences properties, we have a pretty large command in the values of the level of crystallinity that we want to look at. We can go from 90-some percent down to zero. If we go over to a copolymer, we use the proper control. The next subject, the next one of the variables I want to look at would be the crystalline structure. This is an important variable. It's always lamella, but there are some major exceptions. And I like to talk about the crystallite structure, the lamella structure, in terms of transmission intersection electron microscopy done with Dr. Bogmartin at Mainz over the last few years. And before we try to look at the set of micrographs, we can say that the lamella or the crystallites become more curved with increasing molecular weight and increasing undercooling or lower crystallization temperature. They also, as I was trying to hope you'll see, become segmented. In other words, they do not stay completely nice and clear. There are lines through them indicating some break. And their lateral dimensions decrease. Now, we can vary the mode of crystallization, and you see essentially the same thing, except for the molecular weight shift. So on the next slide, we have a series of molecular weight fractions rapidly crystallized. And you can see for the low molecular weights, here we are in 10,000, nice, flat, very long lamella. Everything's still lamella. Here, this is about 10 to the 5th, and it's starting to be curved. This is 200, so this is about 10 to the something. This is about 100,000, 200,000, very short lamella, highly curved. Incidentally, the technique, the staining technique in the photographic reproduction is that the light regions are the crystallites, the dark regions are the stain absorbing regions. The crystallites don't present the result of stain. And then we have this up to 10 to the 6th, but they're so short and so highly broken up that I cannot be able to get a decent slide made to make the point. But you can, as you look closely, you can see that there are lines of dark inside the lamella, and so we call segmented, and we'll see more than that when we get to the copolymers. So although we have lamella, and there's no argument, and you can talk about lamella and folded chains, the structure of the lamella, their breadth, their curvature, vary quite a bit depending on the molecular weight. You'll see exactly the same thing if you went to a isothermal kind of crystallization temperature, except everything is shifted with molecular weight. Now, if we go to copolymers, a set of copolymers that we want to look at, I'm going to be looking at, are hydrogenated polybutadienes, which are essentially close to randomly distributed ethyl groups. Other copolymers are about to behave in exactly the same way, if I can have the next one.